I'm Dr. Leif Tappanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History. I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho. This is The Nature of Idaho. Coming from the 1B, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today, our guest is Dr. Bruce Finney from Idaho State University. Today, we're digging in the mud to find clues about how fish have changed in Idaho by looking at sediment recovered from the bottom of Idaho lakes. You'll be surprised by what they find there. Peter, have you ever been to the bottom of a lake and dug your hand in?
You know, as a kid, we had ponds, farm ponds, yeah. And kind of nice, gooey, ewy, stinky sediment, so.
Yeah, and it builds up over time.
Yes, it does.
You have a record of past time recorded in the bottom of lakes, so it's kind of cool.
Totally. This is going to be another great episode.
Wonderful. Well, why don't you kick it off with some nature news? I see you've got something there for us.
When the micropaleontologist Lindsay Fox of Kingston University found a cache of shell building for ammonifera, of which some are plankton, she knew she had something special. She, along with some colleagues, found samples collected during 1872 through 1876 HMS Challenger expedition.
So this is a boat that went out on the sea and they went out and collected sea life.
Stuff, yes, right. 150 years ago.
Okay.
And so she decided to look at these to see if there's any insight in present day climate change, specifically acidification of our oceans.
Okay.
So, you know, oceans are a carbon sink and they bring in CO2 and there's a lot of free floating hydrogen and then boom, they kind of get together and move hydrogen and oxygen and form carbonic acid.
Okay.
And what she found is that these foraminifera shells were actually 76% larger 150 years ago than today. And the cool part is they actually figured out the time and the location of the HMS Challenger. So when they went and got present-day samples, they were actually sampling them at the exact location and the exact time. So they kind of had a little control going on there.
Great. So we have 150 years ago, we sampled something that we can go back and sample the same critters today.
Yes.
And they found
that on average, these critters, their shell was 76% smaller. And there were some that they really couldn't even measure because that calcium carbonate shell was almost gone, paper thin, wafer thin.
Right. So over the last 100, 150 years, the shells are getting thinner and smaller. And that's probably related to the fact that ocean water chemistry is getting more acidic.
Yes.
As the ocean water is getting warmer,
yes,
it also gets more acidic. And so critters that make a shell out of carbonate, like these foraminifera,
yeah,
make less shell.
Make less shell. And you're seeing this even in crabs and our coral reefs. Anything with that hard exoskeleton, their shells are tending to get thinner.
Very interesting. And I imagine it causes one more stress to those organisms if they're making their protective armor and their skeleton out of materials that dissolve in acid. Ultimately, you can imagine if ocean waters keep acidifying and keep going in that direction, they might not be able to make shells, period.
Correct.
Not a happy
result. No, this is not a happy result.
You know, one of the things that I really like about this study is it shows the value of collections.
Yes.
And of having, of maintaining collections over tens to hundreds of years and the value of retaining that old information so you can compare it to what's happening today. And it's through those collections you can provide tangible evidence that the world and organisms are changing as a result of changes we see in the
environment. Yes, and some of these collections, you know, museums forget they have. So it's a matter of discovering and finding them again. And so this Dr. Fox, she said there's enough jars and samples, thousands of them, that one person could not go through these samples in their lifetime.
Right. Well, that's fantastic. Thanks for sharing that story. You know, today we're going to be talking about history as recorded in a very different way. And we're going to touch on fish and the history of fish as recorded in lakes in Idaho. So that brings us to our trivia question for today, which is, what is the distance and elevation that salmon climb in order to reach the Sawtooth Basin near Stanley, Idaho? You will be shocked and amazed if you've never thought about this before, but it's really far.
It's not a Sunday afternoon drive.
Not at all. We'll get to that and many more things right after the break.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Well, hey, we're back from the break. I want to welcome Dr. Bruce Finney. He's a professor at Idaho State University in the departments of biological sciences and geosciences. So thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
It's my pleasure.
Well, so Bruce, what do you do?
I play in the mud.
You play in the mud.
I play in the mud. What my interest and expertise is in taking sediment cores from the ocean or lakes and then analyzing that material, starting from the top, the most recent layer, and going back in time for a lot of different things. And the things you can analyze cover things from like pollen grains, so you can learn about how the plants changed. You can study fossils of the algae that lived in the lake to see how that community changed over time. You can study volcanic ash layers in the cores to see where the history of volcanism affecting that region, tectonics, landslides, and things related to faulting, and just a whole host of different things. Some of the work I do in Idaho is studying the history of droughts from cores, and there's things that record how salty the water is, which reflects the relative ratio of precipitation to evaporation.
Right. So all of this gets recorded on the bottom of a lake. And I think almost everybody, all of our listeners would be familiar with being out on a lake at some point. Is it just a bathtub with sediment slowly filling in the bottom of the bathtub over time? Is that a simple way or a realistic way of thinking about it?
Generally speaking, it is. You can have it takes some experience to learn where to take your samples because there are some areas that are susceptible to landslides within the lake itself if it's too steep.
Sure.
So you kind of study the bathymetry of the lake, the water depths to kind of figure out where to take it. But in general, you can find places in a lot of lakes that just slowly record layer by layer by layer the history of what's going on in the lake and its watershed and even things blowing in the atmosphere from farther away than that.
How long are your cores? And then can you look at it, how many thousands of years you get within a core or not?
Well, it kind of depends on what your research questions are. And then there's some kind of logistical, practical things that you need to think about. Like it's harder to core a deeper lake than a shallower lake just because in a shallow lake, we literally push a tube into the mud with a bunch of poles that we can screw together.
How big of a tube are you?
About 3 inches in diameter.
3 inches. And so you go out in a boat or in a dinghy or what? I'm trying to imagine how you do this. I've never done this.
Well, so I have a whole arsenal of different toys that I can do. So it's everything from a canoe or just a small raft for a small lake, especially if I have to like walk into it. I don't want to carry a lot of stuff.
So you do this in the spring, in the summer, fall, winter? When's a good time or any time?
Any time is good. Lakes around here that freeze in the wintertime, that's actually a good time to take cores sometimes because you can just walk out. You don't have to worry about a boat and anchoring and things like that.
Right. And so you go out there with just a whole bunch of these hollow tubes and you drop them to the bottom of the lake.
And you use manpower to core into the soil or the bottom or?
In a deeper lake like Redfish Lake that we'll talk about later, which is about over 150 feet deep, you have to lower the tube on a line with some weight on it, and that'll usually get you down somewhere between 1 and maybe 3 feet, depending on how much weight you have. You got to pull it back out, of course, And then we have some tricks to get longer cores in deep lakes like that. And what we do is we have a shaft on top of that tube. We lift and lower a hammer on a line going up to the boat. And so we literally pound that tube in. And so that might even take a couple hours of pounding, and your crew has to kind of rotate through and work on your different muscle groups.
Yeah, it sounds like very physical labor here.
It is pretty physical labor. And so from that, you might get a core that's as long as 16 feet is about as long as I can get a core like that with that kind of gear.
How do you get it back to the surface? That sounds like a dumb question, but I would just see like mud pouring out of the bottom of the coring tube. So what keeps it in there so that you can pull it back up?
There's a valve on the top that seals off, that basically seals the air from being able to leak in. That basically keeps a suction on it.
Suction. Yeah,
so it's like if you put your straw in a milkshake or something, and if you put your finger over the top of it, you can pull the whole thing out.
And so then you just keep pulling that thing up until
piece by piece, unscrewing, disconnecting, and okay.
So I get it if you're on ice and the surface of the lake is not moving on you. Yeah. But how do you do this in a boat?
Well, you bring it up along the side. For a big lake, I use a 16-foot catamaran raft. Those big rafts like they take down the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
And so we bring it we basically are able to bring it up horizontally along the side of the boat.
Okay.
And then bring it on the deck and then cap it up and cut it into smaller sections so we can bring it home.
So once you have your sample and you've got it back to the lab, do you have to do anything to prep it before you actually open it up and start looking at the different layers?
What we'd usually do is we cut the that tube in half lengthwise and split it into two halves.
Okay.
And then you can kind of clean it off and look at it, and then you'll go, whoa, there's a lot of cool layers here, and oh, there's an ash layer from the Crater Lake tephra that's 7,500 years old. That's Mount Mazama, you know. So there's all sorts of cool things that you visit. So you visually describe the core first, noting all the different colors and layers and stuff like that.
So what does it typically look like? I can imagine, again, the muck that I've seen, you know, and felt squishing in my feet as I go to the bottom of the lake. Probably dark in color. Is it layered? Do you see nice, clear layering all the way through?
Not always.
Yeah.
But in a lot of lakes, you do see the layerings.
Okay.
And the color would be typically kind of a dark brown to maybe some greenish shades in there. And
does it smell good?
Depends on the lake. There's some pretty stinky sediment out there, yeah.
Yeah. Lots of organics. I would have organics and sulfur and yummy things.
Generally, it's mud, very fine grain, so not sandy. But sometimes you have layers like that in the core as well.
Very good. So what kinds of things do you start picking out? You mentioned there's volcanic ash that you might see, and that, of course, represents one time slice, right? So that allows you to say how far back in time you are on any given layer, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
What other things are you looking for inside that core?
Well, there's two things we primarily do. One is we take the samples so that we can prepare them for the analysis of whatever the project is about, which is different things depending on.
Sure.
And then we do a lot of really basic kind of measurements on all cores, just what's the organic content of the sediment, what's the size of the grains and things like that. And then so there's that analysis of what we'd call the proxies of what we're going to use to infer what's happening over time. And then another thing we have to do is figure out the ages of the various layers. And so that's for my part of the geological time frame, that's primarily radiocarbon dating.
Sure.
And then finding those ash layers that we can identify to a source. And they're pretty common around here. I don't think I've ever cored a lake in Idaho where I haven't found at least one ash layer.
Interesting. So that again is all recorded in this history at the bottom of lakes, which is really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so how do we get to fish?
How do we get to fish? Well, first, we have to remind ourselves what the life history of the salmon is.
Yes.
And so they're born in freshwater, and they usually live in fresh water, depending on the species, but let's just talk about sockeye, which is the species we're going to be reconstructing from the cores. They usually typically live in fresh water for 2 years before migrating down to the ocean. And they're pretty small when they go out, maybe just like 3 to 6 inches long or something like that. And then they go out to the ocean. They take a couple circuits. People don't really know very much about what they do in the ocean. It's really hard to study salmon out there. But they believe they take a couple – the fish from Idaho take a couple of circuits in the North Pacific, kind of all the way around Alaska, the Gulf of Alaska area. And then they come back 2 years much bigger. And so they've put on almost 99% of their mass that they are in the ocean versus how big they were when they went to the – when they left the lake to go to the ocean.
Right.
And so that's key to my research. So when they come in and spawn and then die and decompose, what they're releasing from their bodies is materials that they obtained from their when they were in the ocean.
Right. So they were in the ocean gaining all that body mass. They return back to Idaho after a long journey. And by the time they come back in here, all of that, all of the stuff that their body is made from carries the signatures of foods they were eating out in the ocean.
Exactly.
Which is going to – salt water, which will be different than the freshwater lake.
Mm-hmm. And the key element that I study that gives a signature of that ocean diet is the nitrogen. And there's a specific isotope of nitrogen called nitrogen-15 that's at very high levels in these salmon compared to the nitrogen that comes into these lakes naturally from soils and streams coming into them. So that's a marker of that salmon, the ocean nitrogen. When there's a year with a big salmon run, there's a lot of that nitrogen-15 in the lake that gets taken up by the algae in the water, and that falls down to the bottom and makes this sediment mud that I'm coring. And then when there's a year with a fewer salmon, that algae in the lake has a lesser value of that nitrogen-15. So you can take a core and analyze these nitrogen isotopes going from the top back in time, and you can literally see how the magnitude of the salmon runs go up and down over time by how that nitrogen-15 goes up and down over time.
So how exact, I mean, are you looking at a one-year time frame, a five-year time frame, 10 years?
It depends a little bit on how fast the sediments accumulate in the bottom and then how thick your sample is. But typically for my work, it's about a five-year average of what was going on.
And so you can track the volume of salmon that are coming into a given lake and how that the numbers of salmon are coming in or not coming in on any given year on a five-year average. But then how far back in time can you get that kind of a signal in a typical lake like in central Idaho?
It depends on going back to pounding on that tube and what you can physically do. But
and the grad students
pretty much
you.
The entire history of the lake since it was deglaciated, which is about 14,000 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then how recently can you get that signal? So if you can go back maybe 14,000 years ago, can you get it? How close to recent day can you get that?
You can all the way up. Right.
All the way up.
So we would use – if we were out in the lake pounding that core in, that wouldn't be very good for that kind of analysis. So we would also at the same site, we would take a shorter core, more – the upper sediment is kind of soupy and has a lot of water in it. So we'd take a very short core, very – in a gentle way and bring that up and keep that vertical and then sample that very carefully to get that recent history. But so for the cores from Idaho, we can study the history of the salmon runs that cover the period of when humans first came to the lake and started to change it significantly. There was logging operations on the lake and mining operations on the lake, and there was a dam that was put in downstream of the lake between Stanley and Chalice called Sunbeam Dam. That went in the 1910s to 1920 or something like that. So we can see all those events in the cores.
That's fascinating. So in the Stanley region, we have a series of lakes there that you've cored. If you go back far in time now, you know, over 10,000 years ago, you have a signal of the salmon runs back then.
Mm-hmm.
What can you say in terms of the volumes that you got back then versus the volumes we have today? Is it 10 times larger in the past, or is it? Can you put values like that on it?
You can. In fact, I have a master's student in biological sciences working on that right now. Her name is Rachel Brinkley, and she's putting together a nitrogen budget for a lake. And from that, we can estimate like how many salmon it would take to make the nitrogen 15 value be what we see in the past.
Right.
So we're working on some ways of estimating that with some precision versus just saying, oh, it was a lot higher in the past.
It was higher in the past, yeah. And less.
Did you see any type of wave type patterns in the past where were there periods where there were significant larger amounts of salmon versus less prior to, in a sense, humanity coming in and affecting that lake?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in the period before the lakes were really impacted seriously, there is some nitrogen 15 is at a higher level, but there is some variability in that. And so we think that's probably related to things like climate change and maybe what was going on in the ocean and things like that. But the most dramatic thing you see in the cores is this big decline to levels that are lower than what we saw for thousands of years before that. And that recent decline coincides almost exactly with when that Sunbeam Dam went in around 1910.
And so make that connection. So what happens when rivers are dammed in terms of salmon passage, I guess, through waterways?
Mm-hmm. Well, the dam wasn't put in with any foresight into like any mechanism for salmon to bypass it, a fish ladder or anything like that. So it basically completely blocked off the fish.
Right.
So all this nitrogen 15, our tracer of the ocean part of the salmon, you know, that was basically shut off for the lake. And the cores just record that very precisely, and it just tails off sharply,
yeah,
in a way that you didn't see for thousands of years before that. And even now, the sockeye salmon in Redfish Lake went on the endangered species list in 1991. And so there's been a lot of effort and money that's gone into trying to, save that run. And since it was listed in 1991, ranged from, just a handful of fish to, I can't remember what the highest number was, maybe a couple thousand on a good year. We haven't had a good year for a while, though. The last few years haven't been very good.
So with these samples, can you make a prediction or look at possible effects of temperature within the lake water or the river systems? Does temperature affect any of this?
Probably a little bit. It might affect like the productivity of the lake and how much food is available for the salmon before they go out to the ocean. But even now, those lakes are such high elevation that they're not anywhere close to like the ecological limits of what a cold water fish like a salmon can live in or anything like that. Our estimates of what the salmon run was prior to the dams is something on the order of 10 to even maybe more than 20,000 fish. It's an ongoing project and we're trying to refine that. So that number is way higher than anything that's been recorded by counting fish historically.
Do you have an idea what our present numbers are for fish up there?
Like I said, it's in the handful to maybe 2,000 was the highest. Yeah, something
okay.
Like that.
So 10% of potentially 10%. What it historically was.
Yes, and there's been some biologists that studied the lake in terms of how much food was available for the juvenile salmon that live in the lake before they migrate to the ocean. And they have estimates of how many juvenile salmon the lake can support. And so if we can compare that number to how many fish came back before the lakes were affected, what we can estimate is what they call a smolt to adult survival rate. And the rates we get for in the area before the Sunbeam Dam went in, and then since then, 8 dams have gone in on the Snake River and on the Columbia River that the salmon have to face. And so in the time before the era before the dams, the survival rate of this from the juveniles to the adults was something on the order of maybe 5 to 10%, pretty high. And right now the survival rates, those same survival rates with what those 8 dams are way less than 1%. So they're not, because of their slower migration times and having to face a lot of different water temperatures than they did naturally, not as many are able to survive the migration both out and then back.
So there's a lot that we can obviously gather out of lake sediment cores in this sort of natural record. Could you speak a little bit about some other kinds of pieces of information that you've been able to get out of Idaho lakes in terms of how the climate changes or environment around the lakes change?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's been a lot of work done, like I said earlier, on studying the pollen grains from different plants.
Right.
So we know that we have general pretty good ideas of how the history of the vegetation changed from when the Ice Age ended up to today. I'm doing some work with some other students on measuring the oxygen isotopes, which is an index of how salty the lakes are. And so we're reconstructing the drought history of lakes in areas in lower elevation areas. And those are some of the main projects I'm working on.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We'll probably have you back to talk about some of these other areas, because it's an amazing record that we have, and we have so many lakes in this state that record at the same time mm-hmm. some events that are commonly happening within the region, and then some that have very specific histories that are more tied to that region.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to bring us back to the trivia question that we started with today. And the amazing life histories that salmon go through, and especially in our part of the state with the salmon runs. So the question was, what is the distance and elevation that salmon climb to reach the Sawtooth Basin near Stanley, Idaho? Can you help us with that question?
Yeah, yes, I can. It's about 900 miles okay. and about a 7,000-foot elevation gain.
Wow.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Over what roughly time span can they make that run?
It's over about a month.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that.
About a month. 900 miles, 7,000 vertical feet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Swimming away.
Yeah. And it's that's not a straight amazing. Line, is it?
No. And that's part of the reason why they paid so much attention to the genetic integrity of the – when they were trying to rebuild – in their current effort to rebuild the run because of the endangered species. Because you can't just throw any old stock of salmon in there and expect that they're going to be able to do that migration. Those fish are very special fish.
Olympians.
They
Olympians.
Are,
Olympians.
Yes. Yeah. You got to tip your hat to them. It's amazing what they do.
Fantastic.
Thank you. I think so too. And so now hopefully after everyone listens to this, when they feel that mud and the muck squished between their toes, they realize there's quite a bit of history down there on that lake bottom.
Right on.
So we want to thank Dr. Bruce Finney for joining us today. And to learn more about his research, visit his page at isu.edu.
The Nature of Idaho is produced at KISU-FM Studios at Idaho State University in Pocatello. Technical assistance and production by Jamin Anderson and Caitlin Hart. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org. Find the Nature of Idaho weekly podcast on iTunes or Google Play Music. For more information, click on the Idaho logo at kisu.org or send email to noidkisu@isu.edu.